This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. We're talking tariffs once again. We're going to speak to the Chief Operating Officer of the busiest port in America, why they're actually quite good for them at the moment. And tennis becomes the first professional sport to give its female athletes paid maternity leave.
It's actually quite landmark and novel in a lot of ways. I think it's quite groundbreaking.
We've been getting reaction from the US tennis legend, Pam Shriver. But this week here on the World Service business programmes and news programmes, we've been following the Trump administration's changing policies on tariffs. And it has been quite a journey. There were tariffs placed on Mexico and Canada at the beginning of the week. Then some were withdrawn, then even more. Let's remind you then of what has happened.
If you don't make your product in America, however, under the Trump administration, you will pay a tariff, and in some cases, a rather large one.
Let's be clear. If Trump is imposing tariffs, we're ready. We are ready with $155 billion worth of tariffs.
Donald Trump has doubled down on his threat of tariffs, saying that time ran out to reach a deal.
No room left for Mexico or for Canada. No, the tariffs, they're all set.
We will stand up for Canadians every single second of every single day.
U.S. stock markets, not surprisingly, off the back of the announcement from the White House that these tariffs would be going ahead, responded pretty badly.
This is, in soccer terms, it's a known goal, but if you want it in American parlance, it's a self-inflicted wound.
It's his second climb down in as many days over the imposition of trade tariffs. First, Donald Trump rode back in relation to Mexico. And in the last couple of hours, Canada has also won a reprieve on goods covered in a trade agreement with the U.S. Mr. Trump says the recent dramatic falls in financial markets, crashing to their lowest level since November last year, has nothing to do with his change of heart.
No, nothing to do with the market. I'm not even looking at the market because long term, the United States will be very strong with what's happening here. Now, these are countries and companies, foreign companies, that have been ripping us off. And no president did anything about it until I came along, and then I did a lot about it.
Some of the key voices and some of the news headlines that we've heard over the past 5 days. We're going to hear from a former advisor to Donald Trump in a minute, but I want to bring in George Conboy first, chairman of Brighton Securities, often in the US, in Singapore at the moment, but still closely following the markets. And it has been a turbulent week, hasn't it, George?
More turbulence than we had in the air coming here to Singapore, Rahul. Good morning.
Good morning. And do you expect that turbulence to continue? Because we know that Donald Trump is talking about reciprocal tariffs coming in on April the 2nd.
Right. Yeah, I do. I do. A body in motion tends to stay in motion is one of the principles of physics. And Donald Trump has shown us a consistency in being inconsistent. Unfortunately, markets don't like inconsistency. They don't like not knowing where to expect things are going to head. And that has led directly to volatility across the board.
It has indeed, not just in the US, but globally as well. Let's speak to someone or hear from someone who knows Donald Trump very well. I've been talking to Thomas Phillipson, who was a former chair of Donald Trump's Council of Economic Advisers during his first term.
Europe is one issue, and then their border countries of Canada and Mexico is a different issue. The border countries, the issue is really a drug war as opposed to a trade war. The president is really concerned about, 100,000 people a year dying of drug overdoses in the U.S. That supply coming in mostly from the southern border in Mexico, but also from the northern border as well.
But it's very little from the northern border, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very little compared to the southern border. That's true. But he wants to take strong action on not only the drug trade, but also illegals coming in from the northern border, which I agree, the southern border is the biggest problem. But it's not as much a trade issue war as opposed to a drug war, in my opinion. With Europe, I think it's much more a reciprocity issue, which you'll see April 2nd. They are tariffing us a lot more than we are doing to them. So essentially, the U.S. is the victim, not the criminal, when it comes to tariffs. And his goal is to level that playing field.
That is the goal. But some would say this week, the flip-flopping of policies was an indication that actually Donald Trump is watching the markets very closely. And when they react badly, he changes policy.
I think it's more what he's getting, which is not clear from the public information that's coming out, I think. What is he getting or not for extending, you know, a month from this industry or extending a month from that country, essentially, is what he's getting in return. He's obviously using this as a negotiation tool to get what he wants, to have leverage in negotiations.
But returning to the question of the markets, you have worked closely with him. He does follow the markets, doesn't he? So when he says, oh, I'm not looking at them at all, do you believe that?
No, I mean, he obviously knows what's going on in the market, but I also think it doesn't allow that to shape his long-run goals of his policies, which are very, very clear. He wants to stop the influx of illegal immigrants, not the influx of legal immigrants. He has a lot of policies to try to stimulate job creation by legal immigrants through this gold visa, etc.
But it's hard for businesses. We've spoken to many businesses this week, both in the US and many in Mexico as well, who say, look, it's really difficult to plan policies when we don't know what the tariff situation is going to be.
Yeah, I view that as a short-run phenomenon, that there's uncertainty in the tariff levels. It's clearly an increased uncertainty in the tariff levels since Trump came into power. I don't think that's a long-run phenomenon. I think that's a short-run phenomenon until these negotiations settle. And ultimately, until he gets what he wants, essentially.
What if he doesn't get what he wants?
The future will determine what happens then. But I think it's pretty clear that he's very aggressive if he doesn't get what he wants. But the reciprocity issue, I think, is very, very important. That's coming out April 2nd. Because all these countries complaining on tariffs, they can get free trade with the U.S. by setting a zero tariff. But they're not willing to do that, apparently.
Yeah, but you know as well as I do that some economies are in a better position to deal with that, developed ones than maybe emerging ones when we're talking about it. On the issue of reciprocity, there are many countries who have tariffs on the US, so those negotiations could take ages. We've just been talking about Mexico and Canada here. We could be talking about over 100 countries facing tariffs following April the 2nd, couldn't we?
No, I mean, April 2nd, the incentive is for other countries to treat us, U.S., as well as we treat them. That's ultimately, we want fair trade, not imbalanced trade. If you look at cars, for example, Germany has four times the car tariffs on us that we have on them. That is not fair trade. So if they are willing to put down their car tariffs to zero, we can go down to zero on them, essentially.
You can take out individual examples, but there is no doubt that the U.S. has benefited from this trading system that we have in place. It would be wrong to say it hasn't.
No, but we are getting treated worse, I mean, by other countries than they are treating us. We're allies in geopolitical and military sense. We're certainly not allies in an economic sense, in the sense that they are treating us a lot worse than we're treating them.
Thoughts on what has happened this week and what we may see ahead of us. We've had further reaction as well in the last few hours. The chairman of the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, has highlighted uncertainty over President Trump's trade policies in a speech in New York. He said he could afford to wait for greater clarity before taking decisions on monetary policy, despite tumbling stock markets and a loss of consumer confidence.
So if you put that in the context of tariffs, if you look at where forecasts are, look at the blue chip, look where everybody is forecasting some inflation effect from tariffs. So it's very likely that if tariffs are imposed, and let's remember, we really don't know what's happening yet. But the likelihood is that some of that will find its way. You know, it'll hit the exporters, the importers, the retailers, and to some extent the consumers. And we'll see what that is.
George, Donald Trump won't have liked those comments, will he, from Jerome Powell? But they reflect what a lot of people think.
Right. I'd go back to your previous guest. And one of the things he did point out that I agree with is these problems are mostly short-term problems. Volatility in interest rates, volatility in imports and tariffs. those things affect the short term. If the policy is successful, longer term should be better. But in the end, markets always adjust. Interest rates go up, it unsettles certain sectors. Those sectors adjust to rates, most of them, and economies will go on. Economies tend to be self-adjusting, but in the short run, that's a very bumpy ride.
It certainly is. Stay with us, George. We know that tariffs aren't good for many businesses, but they can benefit some. America's ports have been busy as companies try and stockpile on products before these tariffs come into place. I've been speaking to Noel Hassigeber, the Chief Operating Officer of Long Beach Port, which in January this year was the busiest in the U.S.
The last 8 months, Raul, we've seen record levels of container activity that we've never seen. In fact, 2024 was a record year for us, and that string continued into 2025. January 2025 for us was our busiest January ever. And as you know, January normally port activity dips because of the strong holiday season and the run-up to Lunar New Year. But January turned out to be one of our strongest on record. And that's in large part because of strong consumer demand that started to taper at the beginning of this year, but remained pretty strong, and a lot of front loading by shippers trying to get ahead of tariffs.
That was the question I was going to come to, that front loading of shipping because of tariffs. Is that still continuing at the moment?
Well, so far, when you look at our container movements, the fact that January was one of our strongest months on record, that's a pretty good signal that front loading continues.
When you say that front loading is still busy, how busy is it? Could you give us some numbers? How much busier were you this January than you were last January?
So in January of 2025, our container volumes were 41.4% ahead of January 2024. So we were 41.4% for the month of January, year over year.
There are many businesses that are struggling. We've been speaking to lots of them because of the flip-flopping on tariffs. You're not one of them. But once we have a policy, a final policy in place, maybe April the 2nd is that day, are you expecting to see business slow down rapidly?
I think the uncertainty is driving a lot of what I would call overreaction, right? Everyone is trying to read the tea leaves, and they're trying to come up with strategies to best position their businesses, right, for potential tariffs. And I think what's important here is that we recognize that we're probably not going to get any certainty anytime soon until at least there is a clear understanding of what the path forward is going to look like, right? So overreacting is not going to help. And I think we all need to just take a pause and do our part to make sure that the global supply chain continues with fluidity.
It's not overreaction, though, is it? If you're a business and you think there's going to be tariffs on your products, get them in early before the tariffs come into place. That's good common business sense, isn't it?
What I mean by saying let's not overreact is let's make sure that we consider capacity throughout the supply chain so that we don't inadvertently create some of those bottlenecks.
Here you are. You were the busiest port in the U.S., in January. That's quite an achievement. But as you look further down the line, the threat of tariffs is a serious threat to global trade, isn't it? Are you worried that we are on the verge of a trade war that's going to suddenly see your port being a lot less busy?
Although we don't know how this chapter is going to unfold, we do have a frame of reference. Back in 2018, 2019, during the last U.S.-China trade debacle, we experienced how the threat of tariffs and the imposition of tariffs impacted the global supply chain. I think we're in a better spot today.
You say a better spot today, but this is a far more serious moment than that was. Here, we're looking at the whole world almost moving into a tariff war, aren't we?
Obviously, from a macroeconomic standpoint, yes, we've never seen anything quite like this. When you translate that into the global supply chain, its capacity, its resilience, and its fluidity, that's what I'm referring to.
There are these reports, aren't there, that there may be a decision by the Trump administration to impose higher port fees on Chinese-built vessels. Could that affect your port?
Any type of additional fee or additional cost will have a tendency to impact the flow of cargo. You have to keep in mind that cargo follows a path of least resistance. It doesn't matter what the source of disruption is. Anytime there's an impact to the flow of goods, you're going to see that cascading effect. It's important to also understand that port activity is a pretty good barometer of trade trends and economic activity. Goods movement is literally the economy in motion. And anything, whether it's a supply chain crisis induced by a pandemic or the threat of new tariffs, anything that disrupts goods movement will inevitably impact economic trends and trade activity.
Fascinating there to hear from the chief operating officer of Long Beach Port, which was the busiest in the U.S. in January. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
There's a lot going on in the world of cryptocurrencies. Donald Trump has been hosting crypto leaders after creating a strategic reserve of Bitcoin and others on Thursday. And he had this to say today.
Last year, I promised to make America the Bitcoin superpower of the world and the crypto capital of the planet. And we're taking historic action to deliver on that promise, as you know, around the table. Yesterday, I signed an executive order officially creating our strategic Bitcoin reserve, and this will be a virtual Fort Knox for digital gold to be housed within the United States Treasury. That's a big thing, Scott.
Veronica Irwin is a New York-based tech reporter covering how cryptocurrencies impact politics and society. Veronica, thanks for joining us on World Business Report. How big a thing is this?
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, the Bitcoin reserve is definitely a big deal. It's something that Trump promised for the first time last summer at the Bitcoin 2024 conference. And it's definitely something that a lot of the industry was waiting for and kind of on pins and needles in terms of how it was going to turn out. There was a lot of debate in recent months about whether or not this reserve was going to be made up of Bitcoin or also other cryptocurrencies. And so the decision to make the reserve specifically just Bitcoin, and Bitcoin being the only crypto asset that Trump is considering having the U.S. government buy more of, was a very, very big deal and something a lot of people were unsure about right up until the minute before.
Do we know how much of it they're going to buy? Where are they going to get this from? Will some of it be confiscated Bitcoin as well?
So it's going to be made up of Bitcoin. Like, the initial reserve is going to be made up of Bitcoin that are already in the United States government's possession through criminal and civil asset forfeitures. They have not promised to buy additional more Bitcoin, but they do say that they're going to assess it in ways that are budget neutral. So the way that they phrase it is that it will have no costs on American taxpayers. They did make it very clear in the announcement last night, though, that while they would consider acquiring more Bitcoin, there's a separate digital asset stockpile with other cryptocurrencies in it that the United States government already has through asset seizures, and they will not be adding more to that.
We've seen, you know, previous U.S. presidents being a little bit reluctant to get involved with cryptocurrencies. We know that many within the Trump administration, J.D. Vance, his vice president, are keen on Bitcoin. But what's driving his different policies here?
Oh, I mean, that is the question of the hour. I've spent all week trying to figure out what.
How far have you got?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell, honestly. Trump made a post on his platform, Truth Social, on Sunday, saying that there would also be cryptocurrencies like XRP, Ripple, Ripple's linked cryptocurrency, Cardano, Ethereum, Solana in a reserve. That obviously did not end up quite being the case. Some of those currencies will be present in the stockpile. And a lot of people speculated then that, you know, was this the result of maybe some donor dinners he's had? Trump has met with the executives from Ripple, for example. And I actually reported that Ripple had advocated for the inclusion of some of those other cryptocurrencies he mentioned in that post as well. You know, the ultimate decision that he made is actually fairly conservative in terms of all of the ideas that people had been throwing around and wondering if the president would entertain, because it is based on just holding on to the currencies the United States government already has in its possession.
Veronica, stay with us for a minute. I want to bring in George here. There are many within the financial world who are still a little bit skeptical of cryptocurrencies. When you have a president who seems to be embracing them, does that view begin to change?
I think so. I think so, Rahul. I'm in the crypto camp myself, not a big crypto guy, but why ignore an asset class that is gaining in popularity globally? I'm not certain I want the federal government to be involved in holding crypto on my behalf as a citizen, but the idea that we should at least accept crypto as an asset class more broadly, I think is a good one.
Veronica, final thoughts from you. Will we reach a stage, do you think, during the Trump administration where they will look to buy significant chunks of Bitcoin to add to this reserve?
I really cannot predict on that. And I do want to echo what George said as well. When I'm talking about the reserve and the other currencies, there were a lot of questions about donors. But I do think a lot of people also look to this industry as something that the U.S. government should embrace and, you know, create regulatory clarity for and support the innovation of. But to answer your question, when it comes to adding additional cryptocurrencies to its reserves, we'll just have to wait and see.
We will have to wait and see what happens there. And George, just looking at those crypto prices, they have been volatile. They sort of shot up, they come back down again, continuing to fall a little bit.
Right. With a new asset class, if you're not up for volatility, stay home, because this one's not going to settle down anytime soon.
Let us see what happens there. Now, to what seems to be a first in women's professional sport. Hundreds of tennis players on the WTA Tour, that's the tennis tour, will be eligible for 12 months paid maternity leave. And players will not have to repay the money if they later choose not to return to the sport. Grants will also be made available for fertility treatment. So really a significant moment. Here's the chief executive of the Women's Tennis Association, Portia Archer.
It's actually quite landmark and novel, because in women's professional sports, particularly sports where the athletes are self-employed, they're not employees of the league or the team or the club, but they're independent contractors, if you will. This has never been something that's been provided to that community of athletes.
I have to say, I was pretty excited about this interview, because I've been speaking to one of the legends of women's tennis, former US Open finalist and doubles partner with Martina Navratilova, Pam Shriver.
This is just another example in 2025 with a very comprehensive, well-thought-out maternity leave for WTA Tour players who want to have a child, maybe in their mid to late 20s or 30s. And I'm also really grateful that they also have a program for female athletes who want to freeze their eggs, because that is another process. Mm. It's obviously not as long as a maternity leave, but it is a process that requires you to step away. And also, it's expensive.
When you were on the tour, do you think a lot of female tennis players made the decision to say, look, I'm not going to have kids at the moment, because financially it could have been a struggle for them?
Well, I think for sure it impacted the number of women tennis players back in, say, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s that had kids. In fact, in my 19-year career, the one that I can think of that was closest to me was Liz Smiley from Australia. And when she had her child, literally all of us on the tour, we had hardly been around a child. We didn't know what a baby looked like. So, but now, really, in the last, like from Kim Clijsters, who's actually here in Indian Wells, and she really started, I think, this modern day trend in 2009. She came back, won the US Open, became the first female tennis player to win a major as a mom since Yvonne Goolagong had almost 30 years prior. And since Kim Clijsters in 2009, you know, it's just each and every 3, 4, 5 years, the numbers have been growing. And obviously high-profile athletes like Azarenka, Serena Williams, Angie Kerber, now Kvitova's coming back. Bencic, gold medalist from Tokyo Games, has just had a baby and playing great tennis. And Svitolina from Ukraine, she's an example of having had maternity leave and come back and played some of the best tennis of her entire career after having a baby. So I feel like the culture and the acceptance, and it's so much more available and accepted. And there's a roadmap of how to have a baby, have a maternity leave, be funded, and then come back and resume your career.
It's going to be important, not just for tennis, but for other sports to look at this as well and to go through that culture change as well. It is happening in other sports, but slowly.
Well, that's right. I mean, listen, most workplaces in the U.S., you get some paid maternity leave. Tennis and being an athlete and having a baby, it obviously keeps you away from your workplace for a little bit longer because, you know, in order to get back to the workplace, you need to be in that top physical form, top shape, get back, you know, to where you were so you don't get injured. And you don't want to rush back, right? You don't want to rush back because of finances. That's like a big mistake that can be made. So this way, I feel like it takes the pressure off. You can enjoy the early weeks and months of being a mom. I mean, there's nothing more special. I remember when my first child was born in July of 2004. It was about 7 years after I retired, and I tried to have fertility help me. I had the worst time, and then finally I was able to figure it out with donor eggs. And when I had my first child at 42, it was just an incredible moment, and I was glad financially I didn't feel like I needed to cut corners of caring for my child and rush back to work and leave, you know. So this, I feel like, is a really important thing.
You, of course, many of our listeners will remember your great partnership with Martina Navratilova. She has been very critical of the Saudi funding that has come into tennis. That is paid for this program. Do you think there are some, though, who will still be worried about that?
Well, you know what? I understand Martina's thinking on it. I kind of, in the last year and a half, when the Saudi funds started to be talked about coming into women's tennis, I've tried to develop an open mind that they can make some important changes in female rights, human rights in their country. And so let's hope that a country can change things to become a little more modern in giving women the opportunity. And in the meantime, obviously, the partnership between PIF and WTA, it's a developing partnership, and it's obviously a bit of a tightrope sometimes, but I think it's going quite well, and I'm optimistic.
Pam Shriver there. George still with us, George Conway. It's a question for many sports, isn't it? Funding at the moment, and when you have the Saudi Arabians with a lot of money, they want to put it into sport, but it can lead to questions being asked.
It can, but if sports has become a business, and I think it's fair to say it has, you want to run your business like a business, and that means treating your employees, your members, your players, however you want to refer to them, treating them well. You got to give them benefits if you want to attract them and keep them. And when there's competition, in this case, the Saudis, it's going to bring up the level of comp overall, including benefits for those players.
George, enjoy your time in Singapore. Thanks so much for getting up early for us. We'll be back with Business Matters. But that is it for World Business Report.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.